Imagine being locked in a freezing, disease-ridden prison cell, completely stripped of your dignity.
Right, and separated from your children.
Exactly. And your crime, well, your neighbors just didn't pay their grocery bills.
It sounds totally absurd today.
It really does. But if you look at the historical record of everyday working class people in the 19th century, you quickly realize they usually only made it into official documents when something went terribly, terribly wrong.
Yeah, I mean, we tend to focus history on the people who built monuments, right?
Hey.
But the paper trails left by ordinary people trying to survive the Victorian era, they often read like a slow-motion disaster.
Which brings us to today's deep dive. We are looking at this incredibly detailed piece of biographical and historical research titled GeorgeWinderStory.pdf.
Yes, and we're tracing the life of one very specific man,
Grr.
George Winders, a butcher from Surrey.
Right, and through his paper trail, our mission today is to look at the realities of the 19th century that textbooks, usually just gloss over. We're talking rural displacement, the terrifying mechanics of the Victorian credit economy.
Oh, and a notorious debtor's prison.
Yeah, that too. Plus a very dark court case from 1862 that exposes how power actually flowed behind closed doors.
It's a prime example of how a seemingly quiet life is heavily dictated by macroeconomic forces. George wasn't really making grand choices.
Right, he was just reacting.
Exactly. He was constantly reacting to a world that was shifting violently beneath his feet.
Okay, let's unpack this. I want to start at the beginning because I really want to understand how a country kid ends up navigating the chaotic streets of London.
Well, George was born in 1791 in Northleigh, which is a quiet little parish in Oxfordshire.
And the sources hit us with a pretty stark reality right out of the gate. In 1794, when George is just 3 years old, his mother, Hannah, dies.
Yeah, and the document provides a vivid look at the immediate aftermath of that. Because the morning after Hannah died, George's father, John, was up before dawn.
Just going about his business.
Right. He was out in the freezing yard feeding the animals. He didn't wake his kids. He didn't pause. He just went straight to work.
I read that and couldn't help but think it sounds incredibly cold. I mean, your wife just died, and you are out doing chores.
I know, it sounds harsh. But you have to view it through the lens of pure survival.
Because there was no safety net.
Exactly. Grief was a luxury. A working tradesman in the 1790s just could not afford. If John didn't feed the livestock died. If the livestock died, his business folded.
Wow.
And he had six, soon to be seven children relying on him. His eldest daughter, Anne, who was 13, effectively had to become the mother of the household overnight.
Because the market didn't care about their loss.
Not at all.
So George grows up in this really high-stakes environment, and he learns the butchering trade from his father. But he doesn't stay in Oxfordshire.
No, he doesn't.
By his late 20s, he's migrated to London. Now, I look at this, and it reminds me of the economic migrations we see today. Rural youth abandoning their hometowns to chase capital in megacities.
Like a modern brain drain.
Exactly. Just because the local economy dried up.
That is the exact dynamic at play. But to understand why the local economy dried up, we have to look at the broader mechanics squeezing rural farmers. First, you had the enclosure of common land.
Right.
For generations, poor villagers could graze a pig or a cow on shared land. But when wealthy landowners lobbied Parliament to fence off those shared spaces for private, hyper-efficient mega farms,
that micro-safety net just vanished.
Vanished overnight. Then you factor in the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers and sailors are suddenly released back into a contracting economy.
Massive labor surplus.
Exactly.
And the sources mention the corn laws on top of that, but how does a tariff on grain directly impact a local butcher?
It comes down to the household budget. The Corn Laws essentially banned cheap foreign grain to protect British landowners.
So bread prices stayed artificially high.
Right. If a working class family is getting 80% of their meager wages just on bread so they don't starve, they have absolutely zero money left over to buy meat.
Oh, wow. So a village like Northleigh just couldn't support another butcher?
No. George didn't sit down and passionately choose to move. The economic reality essentially handed him his father's knives and pointed him toward a city of 1 million people.
So he arrives in London, it's 1819, and he meets and marries Elizabeth Hards at St. Andrews in Holborn. But I really don't understand why anyone would try to start a family in London in 1819.
It was a chaotic time.
From what I know of the era, that was the year of the Peterloo Massacre up in Manchester, right? Where cavalry charged a crowd of reform protesters, the whole country was a powder keg. Why walk right into that?
Desperation, honestly.
Yeah.
London had capital, even if it was highly concentrated. But you are right about the timing. The city was overflowing, filthy, and politically explosive.
So trying to carve out a stable, quiet life there?
It was an uphill battle in the middle of a literal socioeconomic pressure cooker.
Which explains why they didn't stay. The competition in London was brutal, so George and Elizabeth made a strategic retreat to a growing suburban village called Upper Mitcham, down in Surrey.
Mitcham, in the 1820s, was a very clever choice. It was famous for lavender fields and cricket.
So it was pretty rural.
Rural enough to have local farms where George could easily source his livestock, but close enough to the London sprawl that the population was booming.
And the sources show his brother Samuel also moved from Oxfordshire and set up a shop in Lower Mitcham.
Yes, they literally drew a line in the sand.
George took the upper village, Samuel took the lower village, effectively cornering the local meat market without bankrupting each other.
It is a brilliant piece of working class pragmatism. And for a while, I mean, it worked perfectly. Between 1821 and 1836, George and Elizabeth settled in and had six children.
Anne, Ambrose, Hannah, William, Daniel, David. But running a butchery to feed six kids in Victorian England meant surviving the credit economy. And the mechanics of this sound terrifying. The sources detail how a butcher sat right in the middle of a very precarious chain.
Very precarious.
George owed hard cash to the farmers who supplied the cows and sheep. But he allowed the local households and pubs to run monthly tabs.
Wait, so were local butchers basically acting as unregulated, zero-interest neighborhood banks?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, yes, absolutely. You extend credit to your neighbors, because if you demand cash up front, they will just go to a butcher who offers a tap.
So the whole community functioned on trust and IOUs?
Entirely. But your suppliers, the farmers, expected prompt payment. So you are constantly floating the neighborhood's debt.
It's wild to think your family's survival depends entirely on whether the pub landlord or, you know, Mrs. Chapman down the road pays her grocery bill at the end of the month. You're carrying all their risk.
All of it. And that risk detonated during the panic of 1825.
I want to dig into that. How does a national financial panic ruin a local butcher in Surrey? Well, the panic of 1825 was essentially a massive run on the banks, triggered by speculative investments in South America.
Yeah.
When dozens of country banks collapsed, suddenly wealthy and middle-class households lost all their cash reserve.
And if those households can't pay their butcher tabs?
The butcher has no cash to pay the farmer. The entire chain freezes.
Okay.
And because George rented his shop, rather than owning property he could mortgage to weather the storm, he had no financial cushion to absorb the shock.
It's a complete domino effect. And the document traces his collapse. It wasn't an overnight crash. It was an agonizing 8-year bleed.
It was very slow.
We see the first crack in May 1834, with George listed as a debtor in the Morning Advertiser, then an insolvency notice in the Era in 1841, and finally complete bankruptcy in Perry's Bankrupt Gazette in 1842.
Going bankrupt in the 1830s and 40s was catastrophic, mostly because of how the legal and social systems were structured.
Right, the Poor Law Amendment Act of 1834.
Yeah.
From my understanding, this essentially ended community assistance and mandated the workhouse.
Yeah.
But the workhouses weren't just shelters, were they?
Oh, far from it. The 1834 law operated on a principle called less eligibility. The whole idea was to make the conditions inside the workhouse deliberately worse than the lowest paying, most miserable job on the outside.
That sounds awful.
They separated families, husbands from wives, parents from children. You performed grueling manual labor, like crushing bones or unpicking old ropes, just in exchange for watery gruel.
So it was essentially penal labor disguised as welfare.
Exactly, designed as a deterrent.
George somehow avoids the workhouse, but his failure lands him in the Marshalsea prison in Southwark. This is the exact same debtor's prison where Charles Dickens' father was held.
Yes, very famous place.
So what does this all mean? I have to stop and look at the logic here. You lock a man in a cell because he owes money, which physically prevents him from working to earn the money he needs to secure his release. How did anyone think the system functioned?
They didn't. I mean, Parliament eventually realized it was an economic absurdity, but it took them decades of ruined lives to change it. Interestingly, the Marshalsea was shut down by the Insolvent Debtors Act in 1842.
Which is the exact year George arrived.
Yes. He was likely one of the very last people to pass through its gates.
The conditions in a place like that must have been a nightmare.
They were. And strictly divided by wealth. If you have money hidden away, you could pay the jailers for a room on the master's side, which offered a semblance of comfort in a private bar.
But George was a bankrupt butcher whose network had collapsed.
Right, so he would have been thrown into the common side. That meant sleeping on stone floors, severe overcrowding, rampant disease, and relying on charity just to eat. It was the complete stripping of whatever middle-class tradesman dignity he had left.
And the timing of this is incredibly grim, because the very same year George is thrown in the Marshalsea, 1842, his wife Elizabeth dies at age 52.
It's tragic.
So George is bankrupt, imprisoned, his reputation is completely destroyed, and he is a widower with six kids ranging from 6 to 21 years old.
It is a devastating convergence of events.
Hmm.
And the historical record reflects that trauma. Because after 1842, George Winders drops off the map completely for 18 years.
18 years of silence? We know he didn't open another shop.
He couldn't. When a tradesman goes through a bankruptcy that public, they are blacklisted from the credit economy.
Nobody trusts them.
Exactly. He drops out of the trade directories because no farmer is going to supply him on credit and no landlord is going to rent him a prime storefront. The most likely scenario is that George spent those two decades working as a journeyman butcher.
Meaning he's just an employee.
Yes, working for wages in someone else's shop, doing the heavy lifting, the slaughtering, the cleaning, but with absolutely none of the status or the profits, he was invisible.
But the sources prove he didn't just abandon his family to their fate. There is a specific record from December 1850. His son, David, who is 14, signs a 5-year apprenticeship in the Merchant Navy.
And for a minor to do that legally, his father had to be present to sign off as a guardian.
So that signature on a maritime log is proof of life. He was functional.
Right. He was steering his children towards survival.
Here's where it gets really interesting. I find the contrast between the father and the son here absolutely staggering. George is a ghost, right? Hiding from his failures in rented Surrey rooms. But his son David finishes that Navy apprenticeship, sustains an injury, recovers, and by 1855, he is sailing to Australia.
Right in the middle of the massive Victorian gold rush.
Yeah. David is physically riding the wave of the British Empire's global maritime boom while his dad is hauling carcasses for a few shillings a week.
It's a perfect illustration of how the Victorian working class family operated as a decentralized safety net.
How so?
Well, since you can't rely on the government when the patriarch's business implodes, you have to disperse. You send a son to the Navy, you marry off a daughter, you scatter the family across oceans if necessary.
It's a risk mitigation strategy.
Exactly. You spread out to ensure the family lineage survives the blast radius of the father's bankruptcy.
Which brings us into the 1860s. George resurfaces in the official records in his old age. And honestly, after hearing everything he went through, you really want him to have a quiet, redemptive final chapter.
You do. But that is not what the documents show. The records reveal an incredibly dark incident.
It's really jarring.
It forces us not to romanticize the struggles of the past. By the 1861 census, George is 70 years old. He's living in a small cottage in the Rythe in Carshalton with his 80-year-old widowed sister, Anne.
He's completely dependent on her.
Entirely. But he stubbornly still lists his occupation as butcher.
Then we hit March 1862. The Croydon Times prints a very detailed court report. A 16-year-old servant girl named Anne Farage, who worked in George's sister's house, brings a legal claim against him.
Yes.
She alleges that George forced himself on her, seduced her against her physical resistance, which resulted in a pregnancy. She gave birth to twins, who tragically died shortly after.
And George's legal defense was ruthless. In court, his lawyer attempted to smear the 16-year-old's reputation, suggesting she had been intimate with the son of a previous employer.
But the magistrate saw right through the smear tactic. They stated her account was substantially correct.
Right.
But the outcome is baffling. They only fined George £5 and 18 shillings to cover the confinement and funeral costs. I am just genuinely shocked by this. I look at this and I struggle to understand the mechanics of it.
It's a lot to process.
First, how does a man who lost his business, his wife, his home, a dependent guest in his sister's house, how does he still find someone further down the social ladder to exploit? And second, if the magistrates believed he forced himself on her, why is he just paying a small fine instead of going to jail for assault?
This raises an important question about the mechanics of Victorian civil law, specifically the bastardy clauses of the poor law. And Farage did not bring a criminal prosecution for rape.
Yep.
Because the legal system in 1862 made criminal charges for sexual assault incredibly difficult and ruinously expensive for a poor woman to pursue. This court case was strictly an affiliation order. It was a civil claim.
So the parish just wanted to know who was legally required to pay the maintenance costs.
Exactly. They wanted to make sure the burden for the pregnancy and funerals didn't fall on the local taxpayers. It was entirely about money, not justice for a crime.
The legal system was just balancing a ledger.
Yes. And regarding the power dynamic, George was disgraced and bankrupt, sure, but he was still a man and he was 70.
And Anne Farage was 16.
16. Working class and a servant in his sister's home. In the invisible hierarchy of Victorian homes, her entire livelihood and her ability to get her next job depended on securing a good character reference from her employers.
So George's age and gender provided an invisible shield of power.
A huge shield. She couldn't safely speak up, and her situation only came to light when the pregnancy could no longer be hidden.
And once that fine is paid, Anne Farage just disappears from the historical record completely.
Like millions of women in her position, she dealt with the fallout as best she could and left no further trace in the archives.
It's a bleak reality of how power flows downward, even at the very bottom of the social ladder. It paints a deeply unflinching picture of George.
It proves that victims of harsh economic systems are not automatically saints. They are complex, flawed, and sometimes capable of exploiting whatever tiny sliver of authority they have left.
George's final appearance in the historical record happens 4 years later, in 1866. He's roughly 75 years old, and he is in court again, this time fined 9 shillings and 10 pence for allowing his horse to stray onto the road in Carshalton.
Yes.
And on that minor municipal court record, he is still proudly calling himself a butcher.
It's a testament to how deeply tied his identity was to the trade he learned as a boy in Oxfordshire. He outlived his wife by decades. He outlived his sister. He outlived the debtor's prison that broke him and the agricultural world he was born into.
And shortly after that fine for the stray horse, he vanishes from the record for good. But the sources leave us with a massive, fascinating loose end.
They do.
We know David survived in Australia. We know his son William and daughter Anne got married and established lives. But three of George's children, Ambrose, Hannah, and Daniel, completely vanished from the adult historical records. They don't show up in any digitized census, death index, or newspaper archive.
Which doesn't mean they died out. It just means their data hasn't been parsed by modern search engines yet.
Exactly. Their stories aren't actually lost. They are sitting in some undigitized parish register or a dusty maritime log or a colonial land grant somewhere in the world just waiting for a researcher to pull them into the light.
Out there waiting to be found.
Which means someone listening to us right now could very well be a direct descendant of Ambrose, Hannah, or Daniel, going about their day completely unaware that their family story is tied to the butcher of Mitcham.